Thank you for joining us from home. Today, we're honored to have with us Param Ajmera, who will be presenting on his research, Nandabai Joshi and the Insurgence of International Students. Originally, this presentation was supposed to take place at last year's Association for Asian American Studies conference, but unfortunately, that was canceled, and we thought it was a good opportunity, actually, for CUNY personnel to present their work, which didn't get presented. So today, Param is an English PhD candidate at the CUNY Graduate Center and specializes in South Asian American Studies, critical university studies, digital humanities, as well as the theories of archives and performance. Param's dissertation project is a cultural study of Indian international students in the United States between 1883 and 1927. He's the recipient of numerous grants, including the Provost University's Fellowship, the Knickerbocker Award for Archival Research in American Studies, and the Advanced Research Collaborative Student Fellowship, among others. Param is currently a Graduate Center Digital Humanities Fellow and a member of the editorial collective of the Journal of Interactive Technology and Pedagogy. And without further ado, please welcome Param.
Hello, everybody. It's so nice to be here. Thank you to the Asian and Asian American Research Institute for inviting me to speak. It's an honor and privilege to be here. I'd like to particularly thank Anthony Wong for facilitating this presentation. Today, I'm sharing excerpts from my dissertation in progress, which studies the experiences of some of the earliest Indian international students in the United States. So on that note, let us begin. On the 11th of March, 1886, Philadelphia's Academy of Music hosted a celebratory occasion, the 34th graduation ceremony of the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania. What had usually been an annual ritual of local importance had received international attention this year, because on this occasion, Anandibai Joshi became the first Indian woman to earn a medical degree and made news across the world. Queen Victoria, who had openly held opinions unfavorable to the recognition of quote-unquote medical women in her dominions, changed her mind upon hearing of Anandibai's graduation and issued a statement expressing her interest and appreciation for Anandibai's achievement. Such a shift in perspective was also visible in Maharashtra, Anandibai's native province in India, where many prominent newspapers such as the Maratha and the Kesari lionized her and started to adopt a progressive stance on the question of women's education. Anandibai's achievement broke through the long-standing Hindu patriarchal and British colonial tradition of denying education to women and started to change the conversation regarding women's social and economic role in India. In a little less than a year from her graduation, on February 26, 1887, which is also the day when we are recording this video, Anandibai succumbed to a protracted struggle with tuberculosis after having returned to her childhood home in Pune. She had been prone to recurring bouts of sickness throughout her time in the United States, whose weather didn't suit her at all. In her very first winter in Philadelphia, Anandibai contracted diphtheria and almost lost her life. Anandibai's final bout of sickness can be traced to the months following her graduation, when she had to cut her internship short at the New England Hospital for Women and Children in Roxbury, Massachusetts, because of her deteriorating health. Following her cremation, in a most inexplicable act, Anandibai's husband sent her ashes back to the Carpenter family in Roselle, New Jersey, instead of customarily immersing her mortal remains in a holy river. The Carpenters and Mrs. Theodosia Carpenter in particular had been essential to helping Anandibai. Mrs. Carpenter had been regularly corresponding with Anandibai for 3 years prior to her visit, and she encouraged her to study in the US by providing valuable books and advice. Anandibai spent most of her holidays with the Carpenters in New Jersey during her 3 years in America, and she would refer to Mrs. Carpenter as her aunt, and Mrs. Carpenter reciprocated with a maternal attitude. Upon receiving Anandibai's ashes, the Carpenters then buried her in their ancestral plot in the Poughkeepsie Rural Cemetery along the Hudson River, where her gravestone still stands. Anandibai's epitaph reads, first Brahmin woman to leave India to obtain an education. And it inscribes in stone one beginning of the continuing history of Indian international students in the United States. Whereas the epitaph draws attention to her high caste and her most publicly reported achievement, it remains silent on her lifelong struggle against patriarchy and colonialism, which prompted her to embark on her studies in the first place. In a historical moment where Indian women were denied an education, married as children, and made to suffer unspeakable traumas, Anandibai's quest to study abroad must be read as an attempt to change the very fabric of social relations in India. Anandibai hoped to use her American education to build women's hospitals and schools in India. She wanted to fundamentally shift the position of women in Indian society by making a new ideal of femininity grounded in access to formal education and professional jobs, both imaginable and desirable. So why did Anandibai have to travel from India to the United States to go to medical school? What were the circumstances and ramifications of her desire to study abroad? Anandibai justified her reasons for studying abroad a few weeks before her departure for the US by giving a public address at Serampore's College Hall, which was just outside the city of Calcutta. Anandibai began by emphasizing the dire necessity of women's health professionals in India, saying, and please bear with me for this long quotation, I have it up on the slides, quote, "I go to America because I wish to study medicine. I now address the ladies present here, who will be the better judges of the importance of female medical assistance in India. I never considered the subject without being surprised that none of those societies so laudably established in India for the promotion of sciences and female education have ever thought of sending one of their female members into the most civilized parts of the world to procure a thorough medical knowledge, in order to open here a college for the instruction of women in medicine. The want for female physicians in India is keenly felt in every quarter. Ladies, both European and native, are naturally averse to exposing themselves in cases of emergency to treatment by doctors of the other sex. There are some female doctors in India from Europe and America who, being foreigners and different in manners, customs, and language, have not been of such use to our women as they might. There is a growing need for Hindu lady doctors in India, and I volunteer to qualify myself for one." End quote. Anandibai's opening salvo was bold in its critique and insightful in its assessment of the current state of affairs. She called out the hypocrisy of the colonial social reformist organizations who had purportedly come to India to do a whole lot of good, but who had clearly achieved very little. It is important to underscore that the literacy rate for women in India was estimated to be less than 0.25% by the most recent census in 1881. 2 years before Anandibai gave the speech. The 1881 census also recorded that there were just approximately 120,000 women in India under instructions in schools out of a population of over 120 million female Indians. Given the absence of even the most basic educational facilities, it is not hard to understand why there was certainly no provision for women to get a modern scientific medical education in the entire subcontinent. The colonial administration's complete disregard for women's welfare was also apparent in the appalling lack of provisions for women's health, a point which Anandibai also raises in this speech. Keeping note of these realities, Anandibai wanted to make Indian women more reliant on themselves and not on the male doctors or the few white female doctors that were present in India at the time. She called for an educational and medical system that was made by and for Indian women. And given the restrictions on women's education throughout the British Empire, Anandibai turned to the United States as a place where she could realize her vision. The nationalist undercurrents of Anandibai's arguments feel rather gauche to readers today. As the speech moves on, however, we realize that couched within Anandibai's admittedly too neat bifurcation between the native and the foreign, the barbaric and the civilized, is a bold feminist insurgency against British colonialism and the Hindu patriarchy. Anandibai's daring erupted at another moment in the speech when she was unabashed in pinpointing the reason why the colonial educational setup in India had failed its female subjects, saying, quote, "The education imparted is defective and not sufficient, as the instructors who treat these classes are conservative and to some extent jealous. I do not find fault with them. That is the characteristic of the male sex. We must put up with this inconvenience until we have a class of educated ladies to relieve these men." End quote. Anandibai embodies the ideals of hope, possibility, futurity, and trespass throughout the speech, especially in her clear-eyed critique of patriarchy and colonial rule. She displayed immense courage in saying the truth in such a publicly incendiary manner, especially when we consider that she was only 18 years old at the time. As she started making her intentions to study abroad public and began raising funds, she provoked a widespread public outcry. In deciding to study abroad, Anandibai was breaking Hindu dogma that forbade travel across the seas, as well as restricted the education of women. The chief causes behind this phobic reaction to Anandibai's desire to study abroad are rooted in Hindu patriarchy, which had an entrenched tradition of limiting women's freedom and authority by denying them an education. Anandibai distilled the chief concern that she had provoked by writing in a letter, quote, "Hundreds show their scruples by urging that I am liable to go astray and lead an unchaste life when unprotected by any nearest relative," end quote. Anandibai's speech at the college hall was a confrontation with these naysayers, as well as a tactical opportunity to set the record straight and build more widespread support for her endeavors. By studying abroad, Anandibai would be breaking some of the core pillars of Hindu religious code, with the culminating effect of becoming estranged from her closest family and social networks. The resulting loss of social standing would also hamper her attempts at creating a medical and educational infrastructure for women, because she would have lost the trust of the very people that she was trying to assist. Anandibai raised this issue of ostracization during the Serampore speech by saying in a straightforward and strategic manner, quote, "I do not fear it in the least. Why should I be cast out when I have determined to live there exactly as I do here? I propose to myself to make no change in my customs and manners, food or dress. I will go a Hindu and come back to live as a Hindu. This decision to hold fast to Hinduism is of essential importance to understanding how Anandibai navigated her American experience and how she hoped to challenge Hindu customs upon her return to India. It was vital for her to maintain a sense of belonging, because she believed that by preserving Hindu customs in the quotidian aspects of life while in the US would allow her to claim that she had resisted Western influences as a gesture of asserting that traveling abroad did not morally corrupt her in any way. In order to maintain a connection to her roots, Anandibai took numerous trunks of saris, jewelry, spices, lentils, and other diverse objects with her. She would dress as a high-caste lady and eat a strictly vegetarian diet throughout her 3 years in the US. This decision to conscientiously hold on to her culture turned Anandibai into a spectacle when she was in the United States. Within days of her arrival, Anandibai was profiled in popular media outlets like Frank Leslie's Illustrated Weekly, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Philadelphia Record. These articles were then reprinted in newspapers across the United States, such as the Troy Weekly Times, the Indianapolis Journal, the Dodge City Times, Texas Siftings, and the San Francisco Bulletin. These newspapers tended to portray Anandibai as a groundbreaking activist. They often drew attention to her young age, her clothing and attire, her intelligence, her command over English, her determination to maintain a Hindu lifestyle while in the US, as well as the stiff opposition she faced in her struggle to gain a formal education. This public attention elevated Anandibai's profile and sparked a competition among the American medical schools to recruit her. As soon as the newspaper articles started circulating widely, Anandibai started to receive letters from medical schools in New York, Boston, and Philadelphia, encouraging her to consider enrolling with them. Anandibai would eventually enroll at the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania, which was among the best women's colleges at the time, as well as her top choice school. The Women's Medical College also provided significant financial assistance that covered almost all the costs of Anandibai's attendance. When Anandibai started school in the fall semester, she was the youngest person in her cohort. Once in college, however, Anandibai's troubles quickly started to compound. The struggles of managing a full load of rigorous courses, the loneliness of living away from all family and friends, the sheer difficulties of maintaining an Indian vegetarian diet, as well as the bitterly cold Philadelphia winter, took a lasting toll on Anandibai. Her health started depleting rapidly, and she frequently fell sick. Initially, the Women's Medical College had provided a small room with a stove for Anandibai. However, in just 2 weeks, out of an abundance of concern, Dr. Rachel Bodley, who was the dean of the college, asked Anandibai to move into her own house. Anandibai graciously accepted the request and lived with Dr. Bodley and her family while she attended college for the next 3 years. Dr. Bodley's unceasing care for Anandibai helped her get through numerous recurring bouts of sickness throughout her experiences. Despite her frail health and demanding schedule, Anandibai also took the time to raise awareness regarding the abject conditions of women in India. She would frequently speak in churches and even in the homes of prominent members of society. She even went to the White House, where she described the numerous religious and government protocols that created a lack of healthcare and educational opportunities that contributed to the oppression of women in India. Anandibai sought to build on the publicity that she had garnered when she first arrived in the United States and marshal that goodwill towards supporting her cause of the upliftment of Indian women. The enthusiastic public support for Anandibai was most palpable at her graduation ceremony in 1886, which was a particularly well-attended affair. Her contemporary biographer, Caroline Healy Dahl, who was present at the graduation, wrote that over 3,000 people showed up. Dahl describes the auditorium as being completely packed. People stood in the halls, stood against the walls, under the galleries, sat upon the steps, and filled every aisle and doorway. Flowers, gifts, banners decorated the auditorium. And when Anandibai finished getting her degree after the ceremony, she was presented with an incredible amount of valuable books, presents, instruments, and money to help carry out her purposes. Her success at generating a great feeling of concern for her cause opened the pathway for other Indian feminist reformers to raise significant funds from their American sympathizers. We might recall that Anandibai passed away less than a year after her graduation, and so she wasn't personally able to materialize her goals to the extent that she wanted to. Instead, Anandibai's distant cousin, Pandita Ramabai, who was also present at this graduation ceremony, was able to build on the foundation that Anandibai had laid. Much like Anandibai, Ramabai also fought for the empowerment of Indian women and was widely recognized as a militant feminist activist in India. Ramabai had been trying to go to medical school in England when Anandibai was attending the Women's Medical College, but she was unsuccessful in her attempts because of restrictions on the education of Indian women. Having faced unsurmountable barriers in England, Ramabai traveled to Philadelphia for a 2-week visit to attend Anandibai's graduation. In the United States, Ramabai found a much more supportive network of sympathizers who were often aware of the difficult conditions for women in India because they had heard of or even met Anandibai. This welcoming environment prompted Ramabai to extend her 2-week visit to last almost 2 years. During these 2 years, Ramabai traveled extensively across the United States and spoke regularly on the topic of women in India at churches, women's organizations, colleges, and other venues, both public and private. Ramabai even published a book in Philadelphia titled The High Caste Hindu Woman, which included a memoriam to Anandibai and provided a critical appraisal of the status of women in Indian society. Furthermore, Ramabai created the Ramabai Association in Boston, an institution whose goal was to regularly send money and other forms of aid to create women's schools and shelters. The feminist scholar Meera Kosambi reveals that this financial support from the Ramabai Association lasted well over a decade and created two extremely influential institutions. The first, Sharada Sadan, which means home for learning. It was a residential education school for widows. And the second, the Mukti Mission, or the Salvation Mission, which created, which was a 100-acre farm that included a variety of different facilities for elderly women, blind women, sexual assault survivors, and those affected by the Great Famine at the end of the 19th century. At this point, over 3,000 women were housed at the Mukti Mission, and all of the funding can be traced back to this initial moment of when Ramabai was there at Anandibai's graduation. In this presentation, I've considered Anandibai's life and struggles as a way of thinking through the influence that international students might bear on their campuses and in their home communities. One of the contentions of my larger dissertation project is that focusing on international students in the United States draws attention to the ways in which narratives of freedom and progress associated with American higher education and liberalism more generally are deeply related to structures of racialized and gendered dispossession that remain fundamental to modernity itself. By centering attention on Anandibai, I explore the ways in which her life relates Hindu patriarchy, British colonialism, and American higher education, thereby disclosing the intersection of a variety of different power interests. Anandibai's quest to become a doctor required her to fight Hindu patriarchy as well as take on the British colonial administration's careless disregard for the condition of women in India. Her experiences as an international student allowed her to build a transnational feminist solidarity with her supporters in the United States. The international student, as exemplified by Anandibai, emerges as a colonial subject with startling political and aesthetic capacity to make changes in society and engage in a meaningful cross-cultural dialogue. I would like to bring this presentation to a close by briefly dwelling on this incredible capacity of international students as agents of insurgence and as cultivators of solidarity across national boundaries. Anandibai's archive provides a rich historical base in which to begin a search for the potential of international students to participate in cultural struggles over gender, racial, and national identity. Her life attests to the ways in which international students might use their affiliations and opportunities for purposes that go above and beyond the mere acquisition of codified knowledge and credentials. Even as Anandibai sought to earn a degree in medicine, her actions were always steered by the much larger goal of the emancipation of women. The international student's capacity to engage in these fundamental social struggles at a transnational level should not go unconsidered. What Anandibai's life reveals is a transnational praxis of resistance and refuge that emerges in relation to higher education. She allows us to consider the ways in which international students might appropriate the cultural capital of American higher education to create a better world. Thank you.
Just to get us started, in terms of other individuals at the same time as Anandibai, also went to medical school. There was another lady who also went, let me get it, Kadambini Ganguly?
Yeah.
And she, unlike Anandibai, was able to practice medicine after graduating. Could you speak a little bit about if Anandibai had any influence on her or, her separate individual sort of influence on women's pursuit of the sciences and medicine in India?
To be honest, I'm not quite sure about the exact influence of Anandibai on this, on the other person that you mentioned. I really haven't done that much research. But Anandibai's influence on Indian women at large was actually quite immense. Her speech at Serampore was, you know, published and distributed in most of the big cities. And she became the topic of many, many newspaper conversations across India at the time, where people were kind of still working out, you know, the question of women's education, you know, the entrenched Hindu patriarchal and British colonial rule had basically created no space for women's education. And as, you know, towards the late 19th century, this kind of situation really could not became untenable. There was, you know, increased contact with Western women doctors in India, and it became clear that there is a huge demand for women doctors. And so along with Anandibai and Pandita Ramabai, there were other people who tried, you know, to go to college with varying degrees of success. Anandibai was the first. And so she managed to get an outsized share of the attention.
No, thank you for your talk. You know, it's really interesting because right now, of course, you know, there are different issues around international students, work, various types of professional work visas. And of course, you know, a lot of the media attention has been on people from Asia, from China and from South Asia, because they do comprise a big part of, they say, the Silicon Valley and other kind of research centers. And so, you know, what's really interesting, I think, is that, to draw out that you have drawn out some of the positive aspects in terms of transnational relationship. And, you know, it's the same, I think, during that period, you know, we had also cadres of Chinese students, but a lot of that was connected to missionary work in China and so forth. And in India, maybe it's more connected to colonialism rather than missionary work. So I think that the role of, what you've brought out about this sort of transnational intersection is pretty compelling to actually look at the past in order to kind of figure out what's going on now, because, you know, a lot of the attention now is somewhat negative toward Asians in America. And also, you see many countries sending their best and brightest, for instance, from China, and then they come back with, they go back to China, enter finance, the sciences, and so forth. And so I guess this has a very long history, at least, you know, maybe what, is it 150 years now or something, this sort of transnational back and forth. I guess my question would be, I was curious, at the very same time that there's a move for women in the medical colleges and education in India, were there already men or male doctors or male students, international students that were already abroad in the US and other countries at the same time? And I'm wondering why they were not more helpful to their sisters. Anyway, that's kind of my question. Yeah.
Well, there were some very, very few other Indian students in the US at the same time as Anandibai. Less than 10 by my estimates. Most Indian students in this period were studying in England, which at this point still allowed wealthy upper caste male students to study at Oxford and Cambridge. Gandhi famously studied in London, as did Nehru. He's never studied in England as well. And so there is this move, right? Because the higher education system in India was just completely underdeveloped. The great scholar Gauri Vishwanathan has actually written a book where she calls the Indian higher education system a mask of conquest, talking about how, you know, the whole higher education system in India was basically geared towards reproducing colonial rule. America became this one little place where some Indian students could actually go and get access to certain kinds of education that were not available in India. And Anandi Bai, you know, was the first one. After her, you know, many more women start enrolling at the Women's Medical College. Many more even go to places like Mount Holyoke College and Smith College, the other all-women's institutions, which you know, promised a real safe environment for women at the time. Now, in terms of thinking about, well, what were they studying? You know, why go through all this length? And even the journey, I mean, you brought up the missionary influence in China. The missionaries were also very important in India. That's how Anandi Bai managed to figure out, I can go to America. She met American missionaries. But it's, you know, it's still a tense question, because a lot of, I mean, the research has been interrupted by the pandemic. I mean, my own research, I was supposed to do a lot more traveling last year, which has kind of dried up. And so I'm trying to figure out and unearth some more of these stories about what some of these other students were learning. And so, you know, there is a lot of space left to keep pursuing these questions.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Because one of our other contributors, at least to the CUNY Forum, she had done work on, I guess in certain parts of Southern India, there's medical schools and stuff which are in the current day, especially geared for training nurses to go overseas. And I think this is the same in the Philippines and maybe some other Asian countries. So these are not doctors, but of course they're nurses. And so that's interesting that, you know, and it's, you know, is that a legacy of colonialism or sort of Western whatever? But I mean, it's interesting that it's very much alive, and this training of women for nursing from India, from the Philippines, from other countries, right? I mean,
even the Caribbean, you know?
Right. So, you know, maybe that's sort of a byproduct which continues still, you know. So I think you were going to, planning to do more research in India or archival research here in the States?
Well, I'm mainly doing my archival research here. I've managed to find quite a lot of helpful information on digital archives online. But, you know, the way I'm thinking about this dissertation project is I'm basically focusing on a few students on whom I've managed to gather a lot of information, right? So I have a fair amount of information on Anandi Bai. And then after her, I talk about another student, Sudhindra Bose, who was very involved with resisting the Immigration Act of 1917 and, you know, drawing on his position as a student at the University of Iowa to kind of, you know, appeal to the politicians and the larger public to counter, you know, it was such a racist immigration legislation. And he tried, you know, and failed, but he tried to counter that law. And so, you know, I've managed to find a lot of information about him as well. And then I even look at B.R. Ambedkar, who studied around the same time in Columbia University. Ambedkar is probably the biggest anti-caste leader in Indian history. And he also was the chairman of the drafting commission of the Indian Constitution. So, you know, he has an amazing experience at Columbia University that kind of pushes him to think about his experiences in different ways. And so, you know, there's a fair amount of material on that I'm working with. And so, you know, as we kind of figure out how we are doing historical research, you know, in the pandemic, I am shaping my project around, you know, things that are more easier to access. So, you know, I'm in New York, Columbia is more accessible to me. But, you know, once things start opening up, I would really like to visit. There are so many lovely archives, especially on the West Coast, which has amazing, amazing stuff pertaining to Indian students' experiences in this early period.
Okay, thank you. Because, you know, most of the research was on Chinese students during that period. So, you know, this is a new area. Thank you.
In terms of your research, you've looked at, I guess, SADA as a, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, SADA has been extremely, the South Asian American Digital Archive has been very, very useful to me. I'm very thankful for it. And I would encourage you all to keep donating money to it because it has been a real lifesaver in my project. But then there are other archives as well. There is the Hathi Trust Digital Library. There is the Library of Congress's Chronicling America, which is a collection of old newspapers. And there are also some schools have digitized their own institutional records. So the University of Chicago, for example, a lot of their old institutional records from the 1890s, the early 1900s, they've digitized it and it's available. And again, these stories contain, very intriguing stories from international students, India and other places as well.
Do you happen to know if Ananda Bai participated at all in the women's suffrage movement at all, or listened and gave her particular opinions as an outsider in?
She did. She was very much involved with the suffragette movement in Philadelphia. These ladies, they really supported her. They would invite her to speak. Her conversations with them were a combination of, understanding, what is the possibility of democracy and giving women the political power of the vote. But also it was kind of thinking through, well, how does this translate in a Hindu Indian religious context? And so, she was definitely involved with them. She met many of them. Caroline Healy Dahl, who wrote her biography, was a major figure in the movement. And so this was a kind of alliance. In a way, she kind of allowed the American suffragette movement to kind of think more transnationally about the possibilities of women's empowerment.
Well, her legacy is very long-reaching. Recently, Google in 2018, right, had a Google Doodle of her to celebrate her 153rd birthday anniversary. And there's also a crater on Venus named after her as well. And recently, I guess in 2018, there was actually a film about her, right, that was released. Russell, you have a follow-up?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, since your research is so fascinating, hopefully I'm going to follow up and see if you might just write up something, short for us, which basically talks about your research and also how you use the American archives and the archives that exist to glean materials. Because on our editorial board, we have we actually have three South Asians that you might be you may know. One is Vinay Lal, Lal. He's a historian at Contemporary South Asian Historian at UCLA. You also have Mustafa Bayoumi. He's an English, right? Anthony English at Brooklyn.
Brooklyn College. And,
he's on our editorial board. And also we actually have the third one is Amitava Kumar. They are, I think they'd be interested in the type of work you do and how you do it, basically. So I'll follow up with you.
Amitava Kumar also has in his book, he has a recent book about the craft of writing. I forget what it's called, from Duke University Press. And in that book, he has a little meditation on Anandi Bai also.
Interesting
to check it out.
Well, okay. I haven't. So hopefully, you can work with us to, share some of your work, even though it's not finished, but still. We actually have quite good people that contribute and are part of our board. We basically focus on the East Coast, and basically we try to highlight, we try to highlight people who are associated with CUNY, because why not, right? It is a public university, so sometimes we publish things by people from NYU or Columbia, but our focus is basically to feature new work and emerging scholars and so forth. So thanks so much.
Thank you. And I'd love to keep collaborating.